After the excitement and pleasure of receiving the telephone call telling me that dear Mr. Henshaw was a winner of the 1984 Newbery Award, my first thought was, I have to give a speech. Over 60 acceptance speeches have preceded mine. For over 30 years, I have spoken about my life and work until I feel the subject is frayed beyond repair. So I begin, trying to feel undaunted, by saying thank you to members of the American Library Association who have wished me well over the years, and to the Newbery Committee for honoring a book that can be read by 8, 9, and 10-year-old children. These early years, I believe, are the years in which children's imaginations may be captured by the printed word. If books evade young readers during these years, the joys of reading may be lost forever. Although children are not present this evening, I should also like to thank, pass it on, the thousands who have written to me in the past 34 years and who are the inspiration for dear Mr. Henshaw. I might not be standing here this evening if it were not for a succession of aloof, exacting English teachers in Portland, Oregon, to whom I am indebted for their teaching and for their comments, very funny, and you show talent, on my stories. Such lavish praise was rare and precious, for praise was meager in those days. Hand out an overdose, and the youth of Oregon would be spoiled forever. The most important teacher of all, however, was my mother, whose praise was almost non-existent. Because I was an only child, she felt I was in dire danger of being spoiled, perhaps even spoiled rotten. My mother was an independent, determined, vivacious, intense woman, ambivalent about the life she led. She had unshakable faith in the importance of books, reading, and libraries. And in many ways, her thinking was ahead of her time. She had both a sense of humor and a sense of drama, and a way of describing with lively eyes and animated hands any event exciting to her. I regret that she did not live to experience the eruption of nearby Mount St. Helens. Around the turn of the century, my mother and two cousins, armed with classic liberal high school diplomas and letters of recommendation from a year or two of teaching, boarded a train in Michigan and came out west to teach in the sagebrush country of eastern Washington, where they had, as she often said, a high old time. Single women were scarce. Single men were plentiful. My mother loved teaching, but marriage ended her career. For at that time, married women who lived in small towns were usually prohibited from teaching. Years later, my mother was still able to help neighborhood students with Latin and mathematics. When she was in her 70s, worn down by life and by years of caring for her own mother, she admitted that those years of teaching in one-room schoolhouses were the happiest of her life. My mother had, however, one pupil. Me. She taught me constantly. Her words still play through my mind. Always sift cake flour before measuring. Windows washed when the sun is shining will streak. All the advice followed by excellent housekeepers when I was growing up. Otherwise, what would the neighbors think? In addition to her homely directions, my mother had more important wisdom to impart to her pupil. Reading is to the mind as exercise is to the body. Every time a jogger thumps past our house, I wonder whether he goes home and spends equal time reading. I was constantly directed to use my imagination and my ingenuity and to stand on my own two feet. One of her assignments was, go ahead and be somebody. During the Great Depression, her text was, every woman should have an income of her own. Another assignment was, always try to make the world a better place. Cleaning up my room was the way to begin. When a teacher required a composition, my mother always said, remember, the best writing is simple writing, and produced her own high school rhetoric book to prove it. Unless I was assigned an essay on William Gorgas clearing the Isthmus of Panama of rats and mosquitoes, or that topic I resented most of all, could Beowulf make the team, she added, write something funny. People always enjoy something that makes them laugh. Her final and mysterious advice, followed by laughter, was, don't forget, you are related to Ringlardner by divorce. I know this unrelationship is remote but true, for my mother mentioned names. However, we can't remember everything our mothers tell us, can we? When teachers began to inspire me with their comments, my mother encouraged me to become a writer, but cautioned me that writing was an unreliable livelihood. Every woman must be able to support herself and, if necessary, her children, was one of her favorite precepts. And so, with some hardship to my parents, I was sent off to college, not to catch a husband, as was the custom for young women of that time and place, but to become independent. I became a children's librarian, the next best thing to writing, married the man I had met in college, and when the right moment came, 35 years ago, I wrote simply a funny book about a boy named Henry Huggins, and set it in the neighborhood in which I had lived when I was his age. The children's editor at Morrow, the first to whom I submitted the manuscript, accepted it. My mother's teaching was sound. This brings me, as my English teachers would have said, to the body of my talk. Children. That beautiful word so often today replaced by kids. We talk about excellence in children's books and their place in the mainstream of literature, but say little about readers. There are those who feel that children need not be considered when evaluating their books. I am not one of them. Neither do I believe that children have natural good taste and that any book they are willing to read is therefore worthwhile. Soon after the publication of Henry Huggins in 1950, children began to write to me, many as school assignments, letters carefully or carelessly written, almost all conforming to a teacher's instructions, because my books are read at the age children are taught letter writing. I now receive thousands of letters every year, more than I can answer. I am haunted by disappointed children. Most letters say the writer has read and enjoyed my books. Some say they have read them over and over. A few express resentment at being required to write. I am on their side. Many children manage an original sentence or two. One girl interrupted her proper school letter with the words, growl, 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 shut up, tummy. Another closed with, well, this is one thing in the mailbox that is not a bill. Last sentences often reveal what is on the child's mind, and rare children write long, spontaneous letters that are a joy to read. The diversity of the lives of children amazes me. A crop duster's son in South Dakota, children who dislike living in mobile homes, a lonely little girl whose father is stationed in the Philippines and who has brought her friends with her in books, a child whose family built a log cabin in the woods and who lives without electricity. Children of all races, I know from the pictures they enclose, who write as children with no mention of color. Blind children whose teachers translate their braille letters. Brain-damaged children whose brave letters are barely intelligible. Wealthy children who write of horses, swimming pools, and the latest video equipment. Poor children. One girl wrote a happy letter listing her Christmas presents, pajamas, a sweater, and a toothbrush. Inner-city children who wish they could live in Henry Huggins' neighborhood. Boys and girls who live in children's homes. One girl wrote, I used to have a father. My grandma says he loved to read, so naturally I take after him. Farm children who almost always write interesting letters. A girl who wrote that she has read my books in cars, trucks, and jeeps. Refugee children who write meticulous letters and whose teachers enclose notes describing the terrors the children have survived to reach the United States or Canada. Children who live on streets named Bunny Run, Sodom, or Enchanted Freeway. Children who hate reading. Children who say they can't get enough of reading. happy children, grieving children, exuberant children, sick children. The saddest letter I have ever received came from a boy with a Spanish name who wrote, "I am a cancer victim. Life is as short as the wind." Adults often ask me whether, over the years of receiving letters from young readers, I have noticed changes in children. Yes and no. Their deepest feelings remain the same. Letters reveal that children want to love and be loved by two parents in a united family. Many children describe their families and say, "I love them all." Children want pets, and if they have them, often list them ahead of brothers and sisters. They want to get along with their siblings, but express a need for their improvement, especially in brothers. An amazing number have little brothers or sisters exactly like Ramona. They want teachers who like them. Some want many friends, while others are comfortable with one or two best friends. Most appear to be resilient, and like the little girl who was happy to receive a toothbrush for Christmas, accept without complaint whatever circumstances life hands them. They want books they can understand, books in which they do not get lost in the first chapter and can't tell what the author is talking about. However, in the past 7 or 8 years, letters have begun to reflect changes in society that affect children. As parents grow critical of public education, an increasing number of children write from private schools, expensive private schools in New York, country day schools, religious schools, and academies. Some children ask whether I have been saved. The most noticeable change is in the increase in demands children feel free and are even encouraged to make on authors. Has the me generation, I wonder, produced a gimme generation? Today, every male brings demands for books, something unheard of a few years ago, when a child might wish he had a book, but never asked outright for it. Children demand answers in an author's own handwriting by a certain date and say they get extra credit for an answer. They expect authors to participate in a variety of school projects. One project requires children to ask for something from my wastebasket, along with an explanation as to how the discarded item relates to my life. Hundreds of children now begin by saying, "I am in a gifted and talented program. We are studying authors. Please answer the following questions." Their lists of 5 to 30 questions sometimes include, "What are your books about?" and almost always end with, "Give me some tips on writing." The ghost of my mother whispers over my shoulder, "Stand on your own 2 feet. Go to the library. Read." While I wonder what would happen if I sent long lists of questions for children to answer. The temptation is great. I compose a few questions. Children have grown more sophisticated, at least on the surface. Letters written on computers are beginning to arrive. A boy inquires about my stock portfolio. A girl asks, "Could you tell me about your love life if it is not a secret?" Several boys have expressed a love of guns. Mothers who stay home to care for their families are dismissed with, "My mother just stays home and works around the house," even though that mother may have a family of 6. Recently, children have begun to refer to writing as a business and want to know whether I make a lot of money and get a lot of publicity. They have no idea of the meaning of plagiarism. They tell me they plan to write books about my characters when they grow up. A new and frequent question is, "Don't you just take parts of different books and sort of mix them around?" They ask whether I get my ideas from television shows or movies. Boys tell me they want to be comedians, cartoonists, or professional athletes. Many girls, influenced by the Olympics on television, are working at gymnastics and ice skating. Others tell me they want to be stars, or they want to be famous and get a lot of publicity. But for doing what, they do not say. Many children seem to feel that anything that requires an effort to master, including reading, is a bore and not worthwhile. A sixth grade girl tells me, I am one of those people who don't think a lot. The last sentences of letters are often a revelation of the dark and lonely side of childhood, as if the writer is reaching out for help but has no one to turn to. A 10-year-old girl writes, my hobbies are collecting stickers, riding boys' 10-speed bikes, doing nothing at school, and having no friends, listening to the radio all day long. That's my whole life. A boy confesses, everyone at school thinks I'm a klutz. It can really get on your nerves after a while. Another child tells me, my parents are divorced. My dad is the kind who never wants to be around kids. Many children say they remain with their mothers, but their pets live with their father. A girl confides, I wish I could sue my parents for malpractice, but I know I can't, so I just try to forget what they do. A boy refuses to capitalize the name of his school because he doesn't like it. My book, Runaway Ralph, brings forth the comment, I had a father named Ralph once, but he ran away. Another boy writes, Ralph wants to run away. That's how I feel about my father. My father gets me mad. I want to get custody of my mother, but I'm not sure. My mother is better. The letters from almost every child in one class contain such statements as, Mr. Quimby should have kicked Mrs. Quimby in the butt, or Mr. Quimby should have given Mrs. Quimby a bloody nose. Many children tell me Ramona should be spanked. Recently, two boys from different parts of the United States wrote asking why I live in this country. I wonder whether this is the start of a new trend. On the positive side, an increasing number of children write of turning to books for comfort. A girl with four brothers goes to her room and reads whenever she gets mad. Children write of reading when they are lonely, sad, or afraid. Many read after bedtime by a flashlight hidden underneath the blankets, as I did when I was their age. The past few months have made me think books may be gaining on the temptations of television. One girl wrote, there are five people in my family, so you know how hard it is to get the TV set. I just go to my room and read. Another said that reading was better than television because the pictures were in her head. And still another, reading is like having your own little television set in your head. A New York City child tells me, my father says the library is my best friend. The library was my best friend, too, and still is. Readers often suggest books for me to write about Henry or Ramona, or books featuring themselves as central characters. A suggestion that stayed with me came in 1982 from several boys unknown to one another. Please write a book about a boy whose parents are divorced. For some time, I had been thinking about writing a different sort of book, because I find change refreshing, and because I had noticed that, although I have written a variety of books, I was being stereotyped as always writing a certain kind of book. The new one would be about a boy. Girls, it appeared to me, had taken over children's literature. A story began to fall into place. Lee Botts, child of divorce, living with his mother, longing for his father. Those thoughts that are jumbled in an author's mind began to separate themselves and cling to this nucleus. An overheard sentence spoken in grief by a strange woman. It's so terrible when his father promises to call and doesn't. A remark by a teacher. This kid in my class rigged up a burglar alarm for his lunchbox. It made a terrible racket. These were joined by boys' pride in fathers who drive tractor-trailer rigs, grief at the loss of a pet, loneliness in a new school. My own idle thoughts about sending children lists of questions were no longer idle. Letters to an author who sends questions and demands answers, followed by a diary, seemed right. Let the boy reveal his own feelings, for I believe children who want to write should look within themselves, not within the books of others. One problem was the author Lee was to write to. He must be a young, footloose male whose books did not resemble mine. Creating Mr. Henshaw, a name plucked from an obituary column, I read names any place I can find them, was great fun, for he writes the books I have wanted to write but could not. His ways to amuse a dog goes back to the 1940s, when I first heard that bookseller's legend of the woman who misunderstood the title of a book called 40 Days of Musa Daw and asked for 40 Ways to Amuse a Dog. This struck me as a splendid idea for a book because most of the dogs I knew were bored. Moose on Toast came out of a visit to Alaska, where a librarian asked, with desperation in her voice, whether I would like to take home some moose sausage. Her husband had shot a moose, and the family of three was faced with eating 1,000 pounds of moose meat from their freezer. When I mentioned this to other librarians as having humorous possibilities for a story, no one was amused. All had a moose or a part of a moose in their freezers. This discouraged me, but would not discourage Mr. Henshaw, who would spend his time in Alaska climbing mountains instead of speaking at banquets, and would be hungry enough to eat a moose, even though I was told it is dry and stringy. Mr. Henshaw's third and more serious book, Beggar Bears, about bear cubs in Yellowstone National Park who are taught to beg instead of forage, and whose mothers die from eating plastic bags, is another book I could not write because I lack a naturalist's knowledge. Footloose Mr. Henshaw was free to travel and research bears. When Dear Mr. Henshaw was published, almost every note on the Christmas cards we received asked, "How come you know so much about trucks?" Fortunately, our son had been able to answer my questions. When he was in college, he worked summers in produce warehouses and packing sheds, where he came to know the ways of truckers. I also visited a truck repair yard in Salinas, not an easy experience, for the dusty truckers found my asking questions amusing, and I had to be wary of having my leg pulled. Our son also rigged for me a lunchbox with an alarm that does indeed go off with a racket. I was tempted to bring it along to demonstrate tonight, but was deterred by the thought of panic that wires and a battery would incite in the airport. Dear Mr. Henshaw was a most satisfying book to write. It almost seemed to write itself. Because I find life humorous, sorrowful, and filled with problems that have no solutions, my intent was to write about the feelings of a lonely boy, and to avoid the genre of the problem novel. David Ruther, my third-generation editor, understood and was enthusiastic. As soon as the book was published, more letters, the first from adults, arrived. Some said it was the best book I had ever written. Others expressed disappointment, even indignation, that I had not written a book as funny as the Ramona books. This surprised me. Writers of humor for children often hear that they just write funny stories and are made aware, even though they know it is wrong, that serious books are considered superior. A couple of people said they liked the book themselves but expressed doubts about giving it to children because it wasn't funny and because Lee's parents were not reconciled at the end, a conclusion that I felt would be sentimental, dishonest, and a source of false hope to many children. Teachers wrote that the book would be valuable for classroom discussion because so many pupils came from single-parent homes. Mothers struggling to rear sons without help from fathers wrote moving letters of appreciation. Then letters from children began to arrive. The first came from a boy with two parents whose father owns a gas station in Lee's town. He said he read Dear Mr. Henshaw straight through the day he bought it, and 5 times the next week. Others said it was my best book. Children found more of the humor in the story than adults and expressed interest in Lee's lunchbox alarm, although one girl wrote a wistful letter saying she never had anything good in her lunch. Another girl wrote me she was so glad Lee's parents did not get together at the end. Many told me how hard life is in a new school, that their lives were very much like Lee's, or that there were lots of kids like Lee in their school. Several letters ended, "Please don't send me a list of questions." One boy wrote, "I was really moved by the book. I felt as though I was going to wake up from a dream state and find myself in Lee's body." Other children wrote that they liked Lee, but they liked Ramona better. And why shouldn't they? The rallying cry of my library training was, "The right book for the right child." In a world in which children's lives vary so widely, there's no reason why every child should like every book, even Newbery books. I recall my own sixth grade teacher, who held her 40 restless pupils engrossed by reading aloud Smokey, the Newbery winner of 1927. Here at last was a book about the West, which used dialect familiar to young Oregonians and was not a pioneer story. We read every word written by Will James, played cowboy, and tried to learn to lasso with clothesline rope. In 1928, however, none of us cared to read a Newbery winner about a pigeon in India. No, when I wrote Dear Mr. Henshaw, I did not expect every reader to like Lee as much as Ramona. Although I am deeply touched that my books have reached two generations of children, popularity has never been my goal. If it had been, I would have written Ramona Solves the Mystery of the Haunted House and Finds a Baby Brother, or followed trends and written something like Henry and Beezus Play Doctor instead of a book about the feelings of a lonely child of divorce. Who is Lee Botts, adults now ask. Is there really a Lee Botts, children want to know? Is he a friend of yours? There is not one Lee Botts. There are many. Lee Botts is all the brave and lonely children I have ever known who have found books and libraries to be their best friends.